Mitsuko Ushida playing Mozart's Piano Sonata in G K283, rounding off another edition of Essential Classics. Thank you for your company. I hope you can join me again tomorrow. There'll be more from my studio guest, the writer Marina Levitska, who talks about creative writing courses and the ups and downs of living in a commune. That's at 10:30. Then at 11, my essential choice is Elgar's Second Symphony, played by the BBC Symphony Orchestra. And of course, there'll be more from my CD of the week in the first half hour of the programme, Louis Law playing an operatic transcription by Liszt based on music from Mozart's Don Giovanni. I'll be starting at the usual time, 9 o'clock. And in the meantime, do check out the Essential Classics homepage where you'll find our latest blog post, lots of other information relating to the programme. We also have a Facebook page too, which includes our Essential Classics Fact of the Day. And join me tomorrow if you can, any time between 9 and 12. Essential Classics is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3.
Welcome to the Woodstock of the literary world.
As part of the BBC's coverage of the 2014 Hay Festival, Radio 3 presents a week of special live programmes from Wales. In Free Thinking at 10 o'clock this evening, Rana Mitter will be joined by PJ O'Rourke. And on Friday night at 10,
The Verb is here at Hay, so let's get our flag unfurled.
Join Ian McMillan for The Verb's Cabaret of the Word,
with guests including songwriter Emmy the Great and the poet Tishani Doshi.
Radio 3 at Hay continues with Free Thinking this evening at 10. And don't forget, you can listen again online. Go to the Radio 3 website and follow the links to Hay. The BBC at Hay Festival 2014.
It's a minute after midday, and now on Radio 3, here's Donald MacLeod with Composer of the Week.
The sudden and unexpected revelation struck me like a thunderbolt. The lightning flash of that discovery revealed to me at a stroke the whole heaven of art, illuminating it to its remotest corners. Not many of us have experiences of such intensity in the theatre. Even fewer of us have the literary gifts of an Hector Berlioz, who can so brilliantly encapsulate the overwhelming effect of seeing a play for the first time, a work by a writer little known in France at the time, but whose creations would be a lifelong inspiration for Berlioz. The writer in question was William Shakespeare. There was an additional factor which amplified this occasion into, as Berlioz put it, the supreme drama of his life. The young Irish actress playing Ophelia in the performance of Hamlet he saw was Harriet Smithson, with whom he fell instantly, hopelessly in love. He eventually married the object of his dreams and fell out of love, but by Shakespeare he was enraptured for the rest of his life. His triptych for chorus and orchestra, Tristia, reveals another of his obsessions, death. The central panel depicts the death of Ophelia, inspired by Gertrude's speech in Hamlet, reporting her death by drowning, which begins, "There is a willow, grows aslant a brook." But long it could not be, till that her garments, heavy with their drink, pulled the poor wretch from her melodious lay to muddy death. The original words which inspired Berlioz to set that French version of The Death of Ophelia from the fourth act of Hamlet. The Cleveland Orchestra and chorus were conducted by Pierre Boulez. During his time living at the Villa Medici in Rome, his reward for winning the Prix de Rome, Berlioz had his portrait painted by a fellow resident who'd won the painting prize, Émile Signol. Berlioz did quite a lot of gadding about one way or another, so Signol didn't get the picture finished until late April 1832. It shows the young composer as the arch-romantic, in three-quarter view, with a noble aquiline nose, a furrowed brow under a great bouffant tousled mass of auburn curls, and framed by a froth of sideburns. His eyes stare off to the right, maybe not focused on anything in the visible world, but rather pondering the dramatic, if not actually demented, events that immediately preceded the final sittings. The woman who had been instrumental in shattering Berlioz's obsessive love for Harriet Smithson was the brilliant pianist Camille Mock. But Mock's mother, whom Berlioz nicknamed L'Hippopotame, disapproved of her daughter's selection of a potential husband. Her opposition to their marriage was unwavering. In the event, once Berlioz had left Paris to take up his residency in Rome, the lovely and rather ruthless Camille proved fickle all too quickly. Out of the blue came a letter from the hippopotamus informing him that her daughter was about to marry the rich piano maker Camille Pleyel. Berlioz leapt into a coach headed for Paris by way of Florence and Nice. He packed a pair of loaded double-barreled pistols and two small bottles of refreshment, laudanum and strychnine, and a maid's costume for disguise. Wearing it, he was determined to dispatch Camille and her mother, and possibly the other Camille too, and then commit suicide. Somewhere around Genoa, having mislaid the maid's costume, he realised the whole idea was ludicrous. By the time he reached Nice, he realised he was ravenously hungry, and that therefore he was cured. In the course of the next month, wandering among the orange groves at Nice, bathing in the sea, in what he said were the happiest weeks of his life, Shakespeare came to the rescue, and Berlioz composed an overture on King Lear. it's overwhelming. Did I really write that? Perhaps Father Shakespeare would not curse me for having made his old British king and his sweet Cordelia speak in such strains. Berlioz, amazed by the brilliance of his own overture, King Lear. Sir Colin Davis conducted the Dresden Staatskapelle. During those happy weeks in Nice, there was a mild hiccup when Berlioz was hauled in for questioning by the police on suspicion of spying. He'd been seen watching the ships from the shore and had been observed everywhere carrying round a sketchbook. The police wanted to know if he was a painter. No. Was he making plans of some kind? Certainly he was. What for? An overture on King Lear. I think the beginning will be somewhat formidable, he told them. Impossible. How could he be composing if he didn't have a piano? Berlioz left Nice the next day. Well, after that first searing encounter with Hamlet on the 11th of September, 1827, which Berlioz recognised as the supreme turning point of his life, he emerged from the theatre reeling, vowing not to expose himself a second time to the flame of Shakespeare's genius. But when he saw the playbills advertising Romeo and Juliet a few days later, he simply couldn't stay away. He bought a seat in the stalls. As he said himself, my fate was doubly sealed. That single performance of the play inspired one of his own favourite pieces, his dramatic symphony, Romeo and Juliet. One can see that the way scenes of very different character in the play flow on from one into another would have appealed enormously to Berlioz's nature, and the great breadth of the emotions presented, all very different from the restraint and the marble confines of the unities of French classical drama. Shakespeare's example inspired Berlioz to mix together dramatic and symphonic elements in an unprecedented way. We'll hear part of the score he was particularly proud of from Romeo and Juliet, his rapturous orchestral depiction of the balcony scene with its ardent, yearning theme and its hints of the impending tragedy. It begins with the young Capulets taking their leave after the ball.
Thank you.
in the love scene from Berlioz's dramatic symphony Romeo and Juliet, the Montreal Symphony Orchestra was conducted by Charles Dutoit. Berlioz wrote that symphony after the virtuoso violinist Niccolo Paganini made him a generous gift of 20,000 francs. That very large injection of cash, three times the annual salary of a university professor at the time, gave Berlioz the financial security to be able to temporarily give up his journalism and devote himself to composition. "How ardently I lived during those 7 months," Berlioz wrote of the time he spent composing Romeo and Juliet. "How boldly I swam in that great ocean of poetry, caressed by the capricious breeze of fancy, beneath the warm rays of that sun of love which Shakespeare kindled, and confident of my power to reach the magic isle where stands the temple of pure art." Berlioz was never one to understate his case. Well, I'll end today, as I began, with Hamlet. Some 20 years after his first encounter with the play, on his way to Prussia, Berlioz went to a performance in Riga. It seems to have been this reacquaintance with the tragedy of the Prince of Denmark which inspired him, back in Paris, the following year, to take up again a piece he'd begun in the wake of the breakdown of his marriage to Harriet, a funeral march for the final scene. As Berlioz's biographer David Cairns points out, the death-haunted music, scored for wordless chorus and orchestra, was now associated in its sense of finality and annihilation with a new loss. Berlioz's father died in July of that year. Though theirs had never been an easy relationship, he now wrote to his sister, "It is as if my life no longer had an object." The funeral march which Berlioz composed in 1848 for the final scene of Hamlet was performed there by the chorus of the New South Wales Conservatorium School of Opera with the Sydney Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Robert Pickler. In tomorrow's programme, Berlioz comes to London, and it's here, lamenting the state of things in Paris, that he begins to write his magnificent memoirs. We'll be hearing from The Damnation of Faust, Harold in Italy, and the Te Deum.
Donald MacLeod, and there'll be more from him and from our Composer of the Week at the same time tomorrow, midday, here on BBC Radio 3.
Drama on 3 presents Uncle Vanya by Anton Chekhov.
Ever since the professor and his wife arrived, the routine here has completely gone to pieces.
Life on a provincial Russian estate is thrown into turmoil by the visit of an ailing professor.
You're young, healthy, and I'm old and half dead.
And his beautiful young wife, Yelena.
She's lovely, lovely.
A new production of the version by the Oscar-winning playwright Christopher Hampton.
Perhaps you're in love with the professor's wife.
Why should I feel happy?
I must get away from here today.
My life is over.
Where is he?
I'm not thinking of myself, but I do have a young wife.
You won't forget me!
What am I doing?
Drama on 3 is Uncle Vanya by Anton Chekhov. This Sunday evening at 10 o'clock, here on BBC Radio 3.
On 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock. And with the latest BBC news, here's Ian Skelly.
The Liberal Democrat peer, Lord Oakeshott, has announced his resigning from the party and taking a leave of absence from the House of Lords. Lord Oakeshott has leaked an opinion poll suggesting Nick Clegg would lose his seat at the general election. In a statement announcing his resignation, he described Mr. Clegg's leadership as dire and said the party needed someone new at its helm. Both sides of the Scottish referendum debate have released figures to support the economic case for their campaigns. The UK government said a no vote would be worth £1,400 a year for every Scot. Scotland's First Minister Alex Salmond queried that figure and said that Scots would be £1,000 a year better off if they voted for independence. French police have begun evicting migrants from illegal camps in the port of Calais. Around 800 people have been living in makeshift tents, and the authorities say the lack of sanitation poses a health risk. Activists have pitched tents on the routes around one camp to try to stop the eviction. A powerful faction within the Taliban in Pakistan has split from the main group in a dispute over their future tactics. Mesud tribal fighters from South Waziristan are said to favour peace talks with the government, while the Taliban leadership wants to continue its campaign of violence. The Thai military says it's released more than 120 politicians, activists and academics who were detained following the military coup last week. Internet users in the country say they can't access Facebook, although the military authorities insist the website has not been blocked. The Nationwide Building Society says there's evidence of a slowing down in the property market. The Nationwide's chief executive, Graham Beale, said rapid price rises could be about to end because at some point buyers just start saying no. And the weather for this afternoon, rain will gradually spread into southern and central Scotland. It'll be drier elsewhere, but there'll still be some showery outbreaks in places. And that's the BBC News and the weather. It's 2:30 past one.
Ian, thank you. Well, this is Penny Gore with more recent performances by the BBC Philharmonic in Afternoon on 3. We have Rachmaninoff from Japan and Brooks' First Violin Concerto from Spain. And Afternoon on 3 starts at 2 o'clock. Well, before that, the second of this week's lunchtime selections from New York and from the magnificent surroundings of the Frick Collection. Its long-running annual concert series has played host to an eminent lineup of chamber musicians, in fact, since the 1930s. I've more today from the violin and piano duo of Augustin Haderlich and Charles Owen. But first, the Russian pianist Anna Vinitskaya performs Chopin. All four of the composer's poetic ballade played in sequence. They may not have any specific programme behind them, but they're sometimes said to have been at least partly inspired by the poetry of Chopin's fellow countryman Adam Mickiewicz. Certainly they seem to evoke some kind of narrative, encompassing as they do a great sweep of emotions within the space of a relatively compact span. The longest of the four is the final ballade at just over 10 minutes. ¶¶